And in the, your remarks, you talked about the FOMC meetings being designed in a way that the Main Street opinion filters up. And I wondered if you could talk just a little bit about Ninth District's opinion, either testimony from the Ninth District or data that supports your inclination that it's time to ease up on the accommodation.
So we don't make a policy based on data from one district, even a district as important as the Ninth District. We don't make a policy based on that alone. And it's less, I would say, about opinion from the district, as more about information, talking to people about what they perceive happening in terms of economic conditions. I think the challenge there is, you know, getting sort of the right frequency. What I mean by that is, if you ask people in the summer what was going on, they were saying much like we saw nationally that things were slowing down relative to the beginning of the year. On the other hand, then you want to ask them, you know, how does it look compared to the year before? And you'll get a variety of answers to that. But there's no one piece of information that matters. It's just more, I think, it's very valuable for us to see the heterogeneity across the country, you know, to realize what's going on in North Dakota is going on at the same time as what's going on in California. I think it is very valuable for us to keep that heterogeneity of experience in mind.
Dr. Pochelipoto, could you just explain in the simplest terms possible why tightening monetary policies later on and maybe too abruptly would cause higher unemployment? How did that work that there were those?
Oh, so in the 80s, basically what happened was inflation expectations have been rising. Inflation itself was rising. Inflation was very high towards the end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s. And to bring down inflation, to reduce monetary accommodation, the Fed raised interest rates greatly. By choking off that's the usual trade-off when you raise rates the way they did to try to get that spiral of under control. That imposed and raised the cost of credit to firms, et cetera. And so they cut back on hiring, cut back on investment. We had a recession. That recession was very deep, but it was ended up being a much shorter recession than the one we've just gone through.
And just a follow-up to that, would you expect some job losses to ensue from slowly starting to tighten monetary policy now, or would that not necessarily happen?
Oh, you mean now? No, I think that basically what you're trying to do is respond to the pace of the recovery. So it's more about how many jobs would be added as opposed to I think anything being taken away, I would say.
Ask you if you could to clarify a bit what you mean about, clarifying the trade-off between inflation and inflation. How would you suggest going about doing that?
Yeah, I think President Evans has actually offered he gave a speech in London where I thought he framed things pretty nicely. He talked about what kind of loss function the FOMC should have. And communicating that. So by loss function, he meant identifying what the FOMC has in mind in terms of longer run unemployment, what they have in mind for longer run inflation. And then, when we're not hitting both those targets, how do we perceive that in terms of the losses associated with that? And then you have to add them together in some fashion in an appropriate way. I think trying to communicate how we if you look at the summary of economic projections that comes out of the Federal Open Markets Committee every quarter, there's not that much difference in terms of our targets for inflation and unemployment, but there's no information provided about how we think about weighting those things and making our deliberations. And I think that would be very valuable for us to communicate.
Do you agree, just as a follow-up, with how Evans himself weights? I mean, he gives a 7% unemployment trigger and a 3% inflation trigger. Are those figures that you would
I'd have to think a lot harder about that. I mean, I liked his framing of the problem very much, but, actually getting into the quantities, that's something that I'd have to think about more and also, discuss with my colleagues more.
Mariana, back here, please. Just to follow up on this line of questioning, Chairman Bernanke, among others, have talked about, you know, revising the communications or tweaking the forward guidance as an easing tool. So you're not seeing it that way. You're seeing it more as an attempt to bring more clarity. You talked about a more systematic, rule-based approach. Could you just elaborate?
Yeah, let me say a few more about that. So I'm going to try to break things up into two separate things, which are goals and then the things we do to achieve those goals. Okay? And when I was talking to Ann about forming an objective function that weights inflation versus unemployment, that's really talking about what's our objective, what's our goal, what are we trying to do here? And then I think when interest rates are as low as they are, an important part of it trying to achieve your goals in a certain given amount of inflation, a given amount of unemployment, is how you shape the public's expectation of how long interest rates will be at zero, for example. And that, I think, is when Chairman Bernanke was speaking in Boston this week, he spoke approvingly of that, and I agree with him. I think that's a very useful tool when interest rates are as low as they are, can't make them any lower. How long the public expects them to be where they are is a very important part of trying to stimulate add and remove accommodation. Yeah.
Do you believe we're at maximum employment, and what kind of an unemployment rate threshold do you look at?
And actually, could you also explain what you mean by maximum employment specifically this year?
Yeah.
Well, I think both questions are very challenging. And, you know, what you're generally talking about from the point of view, because the term max employment probably means different things depending on what kind of policies you have available. And so when I talk about max employment from the point of view of a monetary policymaker, you're essentially talking about what level of unemployment do you think is consistent without triggering too much inflation, undue rises in inflationary expectations, those kinds of things. And are we at that right now? No, I don't think so. I agree with the FOMC statement when it says that 9.1% is elevated relative to what I view as mandate consistent. I think it is challenging to know how elevated we are relative to that. And I think the upward movement we've seen in core inflation over the past year is a little bit of a signal that we might be closer to max employment than that 9.1% number might indicate to us. I want to be clear, and something I try to indicate in my remarks too, what maximum employment is might change over time, so that the unemployment rate that's associated with that might be relatively high now compared to where it's going to be in the future. You know, we might think about various kinds of reallocations going in the economy, creating a need for unemployment to get the resources where they're supposed to be going. And over time, we'll get back to 5 or 6%. It's very challenging on an ongoing basis to sort this all out. This is something that I in our annual report essay, I wrote about how challenging it is to try to tease out exactly the level of unemployment that is associated with maximum employment. But I think watching core inflation carefully and accelerations in core inflation carefully is really an important way to make some progress on that.
You talk about the importance of the expectations for inflation in terms of future inflation rates. What impact has the deflation in housing and real estate had, do you think, on people's expectations? And also, similarly, the high rate of unemployment and the sustained rate of unemployment had on people's expectations for future inflation?
These are excellent questions, and you never know for sure, I'll say. Our measures of expectations are always imperfect. But when we look at market-based measures, so what you would be doing there is the Treasury sells inflation-protected securities, so-called TIPS bonds, and they sell Treasuries that are not inflation-protected. And if you look at the difference in the yields between those instruments, that gives you a sign of what they might be expecting about inflation. It's more complicated than that, of course, because risk changes in liquidity, also influences those spreads. We have direct surveys. We ask professional forecasters. The Philadelphia Fed conducts a survey of them. And as well, we look at surveys of consumers through the Michigan survey. So we have a number of different measures we've been using of expectations of inflation. Those have remained relatively stable through what, as you're indicating, a relatively challenging time for there have been significant downward pressures on inflation. My own view is one of the reasons they've remained as stable as they have is because the Fed has done a very good job, has been as accommodative as it has been an important way to keep inflation inflation from going lower than it did. And so if you look over from December 2007 to now, headline inflation has averaged about 1.8%. That's just an amazing fact when you think about the downward pressures on home prices, the unemployment. These are all disinflationary forces that the Fed has fought successfully against.
If I could follow up. Yeah. So do you think, though, that the disinflation in housing has had an impact on people's future expectations?
It's not shown up at this time. And the measures we have has not shown up. There's a question from the back there. Sorry.
Can we get your thoughts on the possibility of buying mortgage-backed securities and how those risks might differ from previous stimulus policies?
So I'll say a couple of things about that. I mean, first, for me, the question is when we want to be providing more accommodation. So the key issue for me is I think we have to be providing more clarity about how we're doing this trade-off between inflation and unemployment. And once we're clear about that, I think it'll become clear about when and how we should be when we should be adding accommodation, under what conditions, or taking it away for that matter. Now, I can certainly imagine circumstances transpiring where we might need to add accommodation. We can imagine disinflationary forces developing, an adverse shock to the economy where more accommodation would need to be added. At that point, buying longer-term securities has been helpful, I think, in the past. I think it does put downward pressure on longer-term rates and is a way of stimulating then investment and longer-term decision-making by both households and firms. Longer-term investments by both households and firms. Should that take the form of buying mortgage-backed securities? I am not. It's not something I would say immediately that I'm opposed to by any means. I think we want to be very careful to avoid the appearance of credit allocation across sectors. But you know, the GSE debt and mortgage-backed securities are securities issued by the government. We have certain range of securities we're allowed to buy under the Federal Reserve Act. I would certainly take it into account as a possibility. It's not something I rule out. For me, the big question about Fed policy right now is more about gauging, making sure that we get right when we take out accommodation.
I wanted to ask you about, you said you would need to think about where you would maybe put those triggers, but what do you think about letting inflation rise above 2%, about this, you know, increased tolerance for above 2% inflation? Is that a bad?
That's a very good question. I think if we're very clear about what our objective function is, it'll be much safer for us to do that. If we do not make clear about why we're doing that, by a careful framing of what our trade-offs are between inflation and unemployment, then I think we risk, if we were to do that, the public thinking, oh, the longer-term objective might well have changed. So I think it's very important for us to make clear what the trade-offs that we're being guided by when we make policy. So if we become clear about that framework, that overarching objective function, it may turn out that the right policy would involve having inflation run above 2% for some period of time. Yeah.
If the Fed reduces its accommodation, and if Washington, Congress, doesn't create any more stimulus fiscal activity, how much are you worried? How much uncertainty do you have about whether there's enough kind of core strength in the economy to keep improvement going?
I think that my benchmark forecast has us recovering at I would say around 2.5% per year growth over the next 18 months. When I say next 18 months, I really mean quarter three of this year, quarter four of this year, and then the four quarters of 2012. When I talk about removing accommodation, I'm not talking about pulling it all out. This is a very important point. We have an enormous amount of accommodation in place, and I'm talking about removing a little bit of it. So but I think the bigger issue is the fact that I think there are significant forces in the economy that are retarding us from getting the fast growth that we need to get people back to work. The 2.5% growth that I'm talking about is not going to it's just not sufficiently rapid to get people back to work in the way that we saw, for example, in the 1981-82 recession.
What are those significant forces?
Well, I think that the key one is the decline in net worth and borrowing capacity among households that's intrinsically linked to the decline in the value of residential land. If you look, we have research in the Minneapolis Fed who's broken up the decline in home prices between land and structures. So when you buy a house, it's a structure on a piece of land. And he's broken it up in between those two things. Structures don't change that much in value because it's the replacement value of the wood and stuff that go into a house that shape that. It's the land that's changed a lot. And $9 trillion of wealth has disappeared since 2006. That's two-thirds of the value of residential land is gone. That's a shock that we're trying to make our way back from. And that's what's slowing down the recovery.
Speaking of that, do you and or your fellow economists at the Fed have any notions about why the Twin Cities market prices, I know you're talking about land prices, but at least in terms of the housing prices reflected in Case-Shiller, keep turning in, declines that are much steeper than the nation? And this is going back 3 years, even year-over-year basis.
Annie, I don't have a good answer for that. I don't have a good feel for sort of the heterogeneity, and some things are easier to, if you think about what happened in Nevada and Arizona, why the land prices fell as much as they did, I think it's easier to understand than what's going on in the Twin Cities. So I don't have a good answer for that.
The mandate dashboard that you described, is that an idea that you put forward for the committee to speak to publicly? And what's the discussion been within the committee?
Certainly the ideas I've talked about in my talk, I don't just talk about them with the public, I talk about them with my colleagues as well. So, yeah.
What's the reaction then in terms of speaking to a mandate dashboard externally as you described, from making the communication more clear?
I think there's the Fed is in a very metrics-oriented, data-oriented organization. So
could we see that at Bernanke's next press conference?
I would be surprised if that happened. That would be positively surprised, but I'd be surprised if that took place. The Fed, as I suggested, is a very data-oriented organization. It's open to new ideas. But, just think about the press conferences. It took a while for that idea to get traction and get place. And what we end up showing in those press conferences, that's going to take time. We'll see how that evolves over time.
Can I ask you about, with the dissents at the FOMC, how much of a chance do you think that there is that you all could agree on something that you could clarify this trade-off that you're talking about? Is there a potential consensus there where there is not so much?
I think that having this discussion and clarifying, forcing ourselves to clarify for the public and for ourselves, to be frank, how we're doing these trade-offs, I think will improve the chances for reaching common ground on policy choices. I'll just leave it at that. I think that, as I suggested, I think President Evans has offered a very nice framework for thinking these through. I think the first piece that he offered, this discussion of this objective function, I think reaching some clarity on that, both for ourselves and for the public, would offer, I think, be a very good starting point. And I am optimistic about our being able to reach clarity on that.
Back to some of the, go ahead.
Two unrelated questions. One, following up on the dissent, do you at all feel or worry about feeling being marginalized because of your dissents? And then unrelated, do you see any potential bubble in agricultural land values?
That is unrelated. No, I think the way that the, you know, I sort of describe how FOMC meetings work, and it's a very collegial group of people. We feed off each other, we interact with each other. Chairman Bernanke is a former professor of economics, and there is very much a feel of a group of people struggling with a tough problem, just like if I was with a group of my colleagues in Minnesota, trying to struggle with a hard research problem. And except, you know, obviously this has much more immediate import, but it is sort of the same feeling of we're trying to tackle this tough problem together. We might disagree at times, but it doesn't mean that we're never going to talk to each other or anything like that, or that we won't listen to each other going forward. In terms of agriculture, this is something that's I don't like the term bubble so much. I prefer to think about it as, what are the risks to land prices going forward? You know, what kind of risks do we see of big declines or big increases in land prices? And what we've been doing in the Minneapolis Fed is trying to keep track of that to a certain extent through the behavior. We look at options on commodities and use that to back out sort of an implied probability distribution for commodity prices. And we've been keeping track of risks on that. Those have been, I would say that there's some risk of decline, but it's not, I wouldn't say it's huge. The good news on the agriculture side is I think that people, when we talk to both the borrowers and the lenders in terms of agricultural lending, people really remember the 1980s very effectively. And I think both borrowers and lenders are very loath to put themselves in a position where even if you saw a 20 or 30% decline in land prices, that would cause problems with the loans. So I think people remember the 80s, and lending practices have adapted to those lessons.
How critical do you think it is to extend unemployment benefits to long-term unemployment benefits and to also extend the payroll tax holiday?
You know, these are decisions for Congress and President to tackle. I mean, there's benefits to them. There are costs to them, and so that's what the fiscal policy, the fiscal side of the administration has to, fiscal side of the fiscal arm of policymaking in the United States has to grapple with. You know, if you reduce payroll taxes now, you're going to be paying higher taxes later, and that's always the trade-off that people have to sort through. You know, that's their job to figure that out.
Back here, yeah. Could you clarify what you said about? You said there were certain circumstances, if the objective function were to work out, that inflation could run above 2% for a while, that might be okay. But that seems to contradict what you were saying in your speech about, you know, the public reading that as a tolerance of higher inflation and a drift toward higher inflation expectations. So
yeah,
how do you square this?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that it's very important for us to be explaining exactly why this is happening. If this were to happen without any kind of explanation of what's going on, I think it'd be very challenging. But if we put forward, here's our longer term objective, but in the short or medium term, we're going to allow inflation to drift above it. Why are we doing that? It's because that loss, and we admit there's a loss associated with that, is being offset by gains on the side of unemployment. So, you know, and Chairman Bernanke talked about this I don't want to put words in his mouth, but he talked about an inflexible inflation targeting framework. I'm basically talking about somewhat of a structured inflexible inflation targeting framework where your structure is coming from the objective function or the loss function you put forward. And if you don't do that, you see, and inflation does end up running above 2%, that's where I think you run into the problem. You might lose control of expectations because the problem that you're worried about is that the public will start to doubt that you really are committed to your longer run target.
Yeah. Are you concerned that the public may be doubting the Fed's concern for unemployment?
No, I think it's a good question. I mean, I think that there's certainly people have voiced concerns about Fed policy along those lines. So that you definitely will hear concerns about that. It, you know, right now, the FOMC shares those concerns in the sense that it states publicly in its statement that unemployment is elevated relative to what it perceives as being mandate consistent.
The role of the Fed has certainly been highly visible in the current political campaign. What do you think the impact of the Fed's credibility has been on some of the criticism that's been leveled at it in the political campaign?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really pay much attention to that, I guess. You know, when I talk to people, and I go out of my district and talk to people about their concerns, and I think we have to do a better job of explaining this issue about how big our balance sheet is and what that means or does not mean for inflation. And I try to do this in the answer to one of the questions in my prepared remarks, that I think people are very used to thinking that if you have a big monetary base where you've expanded the quantity of bank reserves as much as we have, that is going to be problematic for inflation, if not now, at some point down the road. But the fact that we can adjust how much interest we're paying on those reserves means we can essentially regulate how much of them get out into the system. And that means we have the ability to damp down inflationary pressures even by keeping our balance sheet large. I think have not done as good a job as we would like to on communicating that point. Yeah.
I'm wondering, you're talking about the 5-year long period of low interest rates starting in December of 2008. You seem to suggest that the biggest risk is higher inflation, which is obvious, but can you elaborate, are there other risks besides inflation of the kind of long-term damage that this could do to inflation and expectations? What other risks are there?
Those are the main trade-offs I think about. I think there are subsidiary issues that might emerge, but I generally think about it in that way.
I wonder what you think of the notion, brought by Evans, that actually policy is not as easy as the Fed really intends it to be, because there are people like yourself out there talking about the risk of inflation, or the possibility that we need to maybe start thinking about an exit from easy policy. Do you see any are you sympathetic to that kind of view?
Yeah, more clarity on policy would be good. I mean, but my concern is that by the choices the FOMC's made over the last year, it hasn't really provided that kind of clarity. And it seems, as I've indicated in my speech, I think it seems to be shifting the kind of weight it's putting on inflation and unemployment. And that kind of shift is, I think that adds to significant lack of policy clarity. Yeah.
Just your views on Operation Twist. It's looking a little bit in hindsight. The stock market's gone up a good bit since then. Do you see that is nothing more than evidence that it helped boost equities, or do you see Operation Twist having had some impact in a positive way on the economy or
generally? I thought the chairman summarized the anticipated effects of Operation Twist pretty nicely in his testimony in October, that it's not a game changer. It's pretty much equivalent, I think, according to our staff estimates, about a 50 basis point cut in the Fed funds rate. I think that it's a mistake to draw any tight connection between that kind of policy intervention and the substantial change in equity prices you're describing. It may have had some effect. We hope it had some effect, some small effect on the margin, but I do not believe that it's entirely responsible by any means for that that kind of change in equity prices. There are a number of other things going on in the economy besides Operation Twist.
You describe yourself as a relatively new member of the FOMC and the committee. What surprised you the most in your first couple of years?
I'm asked that so often that I should have a better answer to it off the top of my head. I think that I joined the committee in late 2009, and I have to say that I was expecting the pace of recovery to be faster than it turned out to be, and I thought our decision making would be easier as a result of that. I think that the fact the recovery has gone as slowly as it has introduced more, made the decision making more challenging than I had thought.
One more.
Chris, you've talked about structural unemployment, people needing to retrain and go into different occupations. I talked to a lot of people, though, like in their 50s, who do in fact go and pursue that retraining, and it's not increasing their capacity to get a job in anything more quickly. So how do we deal with those people in the economy who actually are pursuing retraining, getting out of those hard-hit industries and still aren't actually going anywhere?
It's a challenging issue, certainly. You know, I think that there's lots of other sources, unfortunately, of downward pressure on labor demand besides just this kind of mismatch that you're describing. I've talked about some of those again in this annual report essay that I wrote on labor markets. Some of it is inadequate demand being driven by the fact that net worth and borrowing capacity has been eroded to the effect that it has. Some of it's because of policy uncertainty that firms aren't reluctant to hire. Trying to get more clarity in terms of the future behavior of land prices, even better than clarity, actually some increases to land prices would be good. And on the other side, I think getting more clarity about the future course of policy, including Fed policy, would be beneficial.
I lied. One more.
This is probably off point. Oh, okay.
In the back.
The minutes of the September 20th, 21st meeting show that at least some committee members wanted to retain the option of a third round of asset purchases. You're on record as opposing additional stimulus. So what, if any, arguments did you make at that last meeting against the idea of a QE3? And what, in your mind, would a third round of QE3 do for the economy?
So my discussion at has been pretty much, you know, I've stated my opinion, I think, publicly, which was that, fairly publicly, that I felt the conditions did not warrant at that time the addition of more accommodation. It is not to say that there are no conditions that would warrant further accommodation. There are conditions that would warrant further accommodation. Even under the framework that I presented today using the mandate dashboard, you can clearly see that if inflation got low enough or unemployment got high enough, there would be a reason to add more stimulus at that point. I felt at that meeting that we should not be adding more accommodation. The committee chose to add more accommodation through Operation Twist. I would say that I did not fully influence the committee's decision at that time.